This is Anthony Anarino, and you're listening to In the Arena. Welcome back. Today I'm here with my friend Craig Wortman. Craig is the CEO of Sales Engine and, like me, he teaches professional selling. Craig has got to be an outcast teaching sales at the prestigious University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. I read Craig's ebook, How to Communicate with Influence, and I loved it. So I invited him into the arena to talk about how to communicate with influence, the power of discipline, handwritten thank you cards, how to do a win-loss review, the power of listening and trust, and the power of stories and influencing. I think you're going to love it. Let's get started with Craig right now. Hey, Craig, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for being here.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So let me have you introduce yourself to my little community that gathers here on the In the Arena podcast. Tell me who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I'm Craig Wortman. I sort of think of my life and my business wearing three hats. So I'm a professor at the University of Chicago's business school called Chicago Booth, the Booth School of Business, where I teach three classes, two on entrepreneurship, one on entrepreneurial selling, one called Building the New Venture, which is really a core entrepreneurship class. And then I teach a four-day class on leadership, which has been relatively new to me in the last couple of years. I'm endlessly fascinated by leaders and leadership and that whole notion, and am really learning it both as a student and getting to teach it. So that's really fun. So that's one hat. My second hat is I run a small consulting firm called Sales Engine, where we help companies build and tune their sales engine. And then finally, like you, Anthony, I'm an author. So I have a book called What's Your Story that looks at how leaders and salespeople use stories to create an impact, to influence people. So it's three hats.
So many parallels. I teach three classes at university too. Not quite as prestigious as saying University of Chicago, but okay, you got me there. You and I share a lot of the same sort of, and I think it's in part being a practitioner and part, you know, what we experience, but we share a lot of the same sort of idea. So I got your ebook, which is How to Communicate with Influence. And it's interesting to me because your book, like the book that I'm in the middle of writing right now, is not a tactical book, although there's tactics embedded in it. Yeah. The tactics are not what would be the common sort of Cialdini, you know, reciprocity, consistency, those kinds of old tactics that a lot of people in sales and particularly in internet marketing have relied on. But yours starts with discipline. And that's actually the first chapter for my book too. Why'd you start with discipline?
Well, I come at discipline, I'm still learning. I mean, what's great about you is you have always struck me as a guy who's learning too. And I'm, you know, people like that are magnetic, and I'm trying to understand this. And I come at it from, I think, a very simple and a very practical place. So when I talk about discipline, I frame it in the following way. I say, look, success in sales, success in business, and I, not to be cheesy, but success in life is a combination of three things: knowledge, skill, and discipline. And it's those three things in balance, that's the key, in balance, that I think make us really effective. And when you stop and think about that for a second, I think it raises some interesting questions for us when it comes to influence it or anything, any challenge that you're facing, where you might ask, okay, I'm walking into this, you know, high stakes situation with Anthony, or I'm walking into this high stakes situation with my team. What balance of knowledge, skill, and discipline do I need? And so here's the maybe the provocative or maybe even controversial part. You know me, I like to stir things up a little bit. I think oftentimes we have too much knowledge. And I often leave a real pregnant pause there because it's kind of like people are listening going, okay, wait, business school professor says we have too much knowledge, that's dislocated, right? And I don't mean get dumber. That's not what I mean. I mean the curse of knowledge, where there's too much too much sort of evidence, research, facts, and they're getting in the way of my ability to influence. So that's, let me leave it there for now. Does that, you know, get us started the right way?
It does. And, you know, it's interesting to me that the way that you frame that, because it's critical. And we have all this stuff going on right now about insight-based selling and challenger models and all these things about knowledge. And we definitely need skills. So I think of mindset and skill set. But then you get to discipline, and that's sort of this application. What are you going to do with what you know? And what are the actions you're going to take? And for me, when you think about discipline and rolling it up under influence, I think about, who are you? Do you have the ability to make commitments and keep commitments that you make to yourself? Yep. Do you have the ability to make commitments and keep commitments to your clients? And you started off by saying cheesy when you described discipline as being the root of success, but it really is. Some people can get themselves and will themselves to take action that other people cannot will themselves or will not will themselves to take action on. And so they get a different set of results. And I think that discipline is that cornerstone difference that makes a difference in how some people succeed and why some people fail. And it's never that they don't know enough. It's never that they don't have the skills. It's that they're just unwilling to be disciplined. And I think from influence, when you look at people who truly have it, you can count on them to do what they say they're going to do. You can count on them to be who they say they are. And I think, to me, that's where influence really begins.
Well, so I love your framing of the commitment, the idea of commitment. It's funny. So Anthony, I taught the other night at school, and as I often do, and I'm going to jump to a very tactical thing for a second, just by illustration, and talk about commitment. I was talking about following through on meetings, calls, interactions with clients. And, you know, one of the most obvious tactical things you can do as a follow through is write a thank you note. You know, you do something kind for me, or we just have a great interaction, and I write you a thank you note. And I said to the students, you know, how do you do that? And, you know, the most common thing is you write an email. And that's fine. Nothing wrong with that, of course. A thank you email is a wonderful thing to get. But it's an email. And so I said to the students, what about writing a thank you note? And then I put on, I call it a sort of mean Craig, right? I put on that hat where I get a little mean with my students. And it's not really mean. I'm just trying to really hammer a point. And I say, you know, isn't that a good idea? And, you know, there's 75 people looking at me, shaking their heads, going, yeah, that's a, you know, thank you note. Boy, that's really powerful to get that in the mail. It's handwritten. It's kind of cool. And I said, you know what? None of you will do it. And I don't mean to be mean to them, of course, but I'm challenging them to say, will you make that commitment or will you not make that commitment? Because we can sit here in this room and we can look at each other and we can nod and go, God, that's a great idea. You know, Anthony, that's a great idea. But will you do it? It's like, you know, it's like anything that's related to discipline. Will you eat your vegetables? Will you get up and work out? It's, you know, and you say it well. Some people will just, you just look at them and you know they'll follow through, and some you wonder. And so that's why I like to challenge people on it.
I hate to say the words that I say all the time, but I wrote a blog post the other day, yesterday, because yeah. I write so many. But it was the secret reason successful people are willing to share their secrets. And the reason is it's not a secret. They send a handwritten thank you note. There's no secret to that. But you're right. When you tell people this is what I do, they go, man, that's awesome. And I think part of the point that you're making there with that is that the medium needs to match the outcome that you're looking for. And an email is just the wrong medium for many of the outcomes that we want to achieve in sales. But email seems to be the preferred method of communication for us because it's easy. So we export that onto the client, who maybe it's not their preferred communication choice, but a handwritten note means something different than an email note, and it means something about the person sending it. I say that knowing I have to type any note that I send to a client, because if I hand wrote it, they would be able to take it to a pharmacy and get a prescription for penicillin almost anywhere in America.
Which, you know, that can be a useful thing, right? That's great. It's, you know, I so agree with you, and there's just so many different examples of this. And it's, you know, one of the key things that we talk about is doing like a win-loss debrief. Is a win-loss debrief a knowledge? Is it a skill, or is it a discipline? Now, you could argue, and I think rightly so, you could say, well, Craig, my gosh, it's a little bit of all three. And I would agree with you. But I would say, yes, it is. You know, you have to know how to do it. That's the knowledge. You have to conduct it well. I mean, I have to get you on the phone and engage you in a win-loss debrief. And that's a skill, maybe. and the timing of my questions and, you know, blah, blah. That's a skill. But do I do it? Because it's not a hard thing to do. It's not something I need years of training to do. You know, you, Anthony, can teach me how to do a win-loss debrief in 4 seconds, right? Or 4 minutes. But will I do it? And it's just that fascinating thing where, what is it about people? What is it about the commitments that they make when, let's say, the worst thing happens, I lose a deal. I lose a big, complex deal that I've been selling and trying to create. And I feel terrible. The last thing I want to do is sort of roll in it, right? But I know that I've got to engage a partner, mentor, whoever, to do that win-loss debrief, to set it up and follow all the way through, because I know the richness of the learnings and the lessons and making me better the next time will come from it. But it's just all those, I love exploring with people all those little elements. And I hope that this framework of knowledge, skill, and discipline is helpful to people, because I really do mean, you know, think about that. Think about win-loss debrief. Think about a follow-through. Think about opening a meeting correctly. And is that, does that come from your knowledge? Is it a skill or is it a discipline? Because I think if you ask that question, you'll be more motivated to say, you know what, I am going to write Anthony a thank you note, or I am going to follow through on that loss debrief.
What's interesting to me before we move on from discipline is a couple things. One, it seems to me that people will think very deeply about breaking a commitment they make to a human being and won't think anything at all about breaking a commitment they make to themselves. And I see this when I look at their calendar all the time. If I have Craig Wortman on my calendar, I'm going to make that meeting. But if I put down that I'm going to exercise in the morning, or I'm going to update my SFA at the end of the day or whatever it is, that's the easiest commitment in the world to break. So you talk about preparation for the sales call or win-loss, and we'll visit win-loss for a minute. But when you prepare for the call and you've made 1,000 calls, why are you going to do sales call prep now after you've made 1,000 sales calls before? And we don't keep that commitment to ourselves because it's so easy to break and we're so confident that we're going to go in and do okay. Let me touch win-loss real quick and I'll get your feedback on this. What's interesting to me is how many win-loss reviews that I've been involved in where there's always some reason that the salesperson lost the opportunity that has nothing to do with them. And part of this discipline is accepting, in my mind, the fact that if you can't say that the reason I lost was because I did this or I didn't do that or I should have done more, then there's nowhere for you to go and nowhere to improve. If it was price or your competitor had the building wired for relationships before you got there, then you take all of the control out and you're really casting blame rather than deciding how to improve. What's your experience there?
I think that's true. You know, I'm not sure I have a strong opinion other than I think every time I've been involved in a win-loss debrief, and I shouldn't say every time, that's too much, but I think many times you just hear something surprising. And maybe it's about you, and maybe it's about price, but then the question I like to ask both myself and my team or someone who's involved is, how could we have anticipated that? How could we have been better at acknowledging that, whatever that weakness is? I think that's the trick. But I think you're right. I feel like I'm consistently surprised by what I hear in a win debrief where I thought, oh, I know why I won. And then I hear something completely different. And that really jogs my thinking. Or I hear in a loss debrief something that is just a really powerful insight that may be a behavior of mine that is repeated over time. That is just gold, which is why they're so important, right? I mean, that's
sure.
That's old in the lesson.
Absolutely. That's that insight that lets you change. So you've got a couple other things in your ebook. I'll put a link to this at the end of it. But you've got a couple things about being a listener and being human. I would roll those up into caring. And tell me, in your view, why is listening, what does it mean to be a listener, and why is that so important?
Well, I don't want to overstate this, but I think you and I are really well aligned. And I like to use the word caring. I just simply say, I just like anything to break down, what does it mean to listen? And I, in the ebook, one of the things we talk about is asking impact questions. And, you know, that's what you're doing right here, right now. You're asking impact questions. They're a different level of question. They're a question that you've prepared. And I think what's really interesting about this when it comes to influence and as it relates to salespeople is many times as salespeople, we're talkers, and that's a good thing. But we also know as professionals that we have to listen. I think this notion of asking impact questions, one or two in a meeting, not nine, you know, I'm not going to ask you tons and tons of impact questions because at some point I turn into a caricature or I get annoying because I'm really, you know, it's like I'm peeling back nine layers at once and, you know, I'm going to be exhausting to you, right? But I think what's interesting about impact questions is we ask those insightful questions. They go deeper. They cause you to express either emotion, and I don't mean high drama, just some sort of frustration or annoyance or emotion of some sort, or they elicit analysis from you. I sit and I listen and I absorb that. And here's sort of the punchline of this. I don't know, because I've asked you that deep question, I don't know what your answer is going to be. I don't know if I'm going to like the answer, and that's okay. And what I say to salespeople is so often people are worried about, well, am I asking questions of Anthony just to manipulate him to the answer I want? And I think, of course, the answer is no. That's what I love about you framing it in terms of caring. I care about you. I trust you. I want you to trust me. I'm going to ask you some really interesting, deep questions. I want to know the answers. And I realize fully as a professional, the answer may not go my way. And that is okay. Does that make sense?
It does. But there's more to talk about the pause.
I love the pause. I teach a conversation model at Chicago Booth that I really have fun with, and my students give me a hard time about it because I feel like we more professional, I guess is the wrong word, but it's we gain credibility and we gain access to better, more actionable information if we can just be silent. And I'm an extrovert. I've had to train myself to do it. My weakness is the classic extrovert weakness. I like to talk. I like to barrel through an argument with people. And I love that. And I've had to train myself, you know, Craig, ask the question, then bite your lip and pause and let Anthony into the conversation because he's got some really interesting things to say. And again, I may like what you say in terms of my strategy going forward, or you may say something that causes my strategy to get derailed. Either one is okay. But the power of the pause, you know, I'll give you a quick example of the power of the pause. I teach this thing called the sales trailer, which is the movie trailer of your business. So mine, you asked me at the beginning about what I do, and I said I run a company called Sales Engine. What we do is help firms build and tune their sales engine. Because what I want you to do, and it happens 99 times out of 100 in any event or sales meeting or situation where you and I meet, if I say that and I can be disciplined about the pause, you will come in and say, oh, no, I haven't changed your life with that sales trailer. But you'll say, oh, Craig, what does that mean? And now we're in a conversation. It's not just me talking.
What's interesting to me about that is this idea as salespeople, for many, many years, the sales acumen that a rep was supposed to have was their ability to talk and their ability to present and their ability to be a showman in a boardroom. And really, that's just not where the action is. If it ever was, I'm not sure it was. But to me, truly listening to another human being is an acknowledgement of some of their deepest human needs. And one of them is being significant and letting them be heard. And to me, when you let that pause sit, it's interesting to me how often, if you can wait maybe 4 seconds after somebody's done speaking, they'll continue on with deeper thoughts than you would have gotten if you hadn't have given them that opportunity to continue on. And sort of they're warming up and you leave the pause at that opening, and then they fill that gap when you leave it there.
I think the power of the pause is just that, Anthony. I mean, I think it's, you know, you said 4 seconds, and I think that sounds as right as anything else. I always just say, give it a couple of beats, a beat and a half, probably a half a beat longer than you would normally be comfortable, and let that person come in. And just as you said, they will fill that silence with something interesting, right? And not just an awkward, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to say something now. And, you know, one of the things I learned years ago from some sales manager I had was, you know, influential and high performing salespeople, they allow room for conversation. They listen, and on some level, Anthony, all this stuff is obvious, but I just think we need to be reminded. They allow for conversation. They leave a pause and listen. They ask great questions, what I call impact questions. And thus, you know, here's the result. And thus they get better, more actionable information. And that's great. And I just add the, I add that last little layer, even if that information is not something you want to hear, at least you and I are now really into a conversation. I'm really understanding who you are and what you need. And that's what, whether that works out for me ultimately in a sale or not, that's where trust is built, I think. One of the huge foundations.
I think trust is the basis of every relationship. And I think caring is the basis of trust, right? So if I know you care more about me than you care about your own self-interest in whatever kind of a conversation we're having, then I trust you. And if I think that it's about you and that you're going through the motion with me, then I tend not to trust you.
I think that's right. And I don't want to overemphasize this whole manipulation point, but one of the realities of one of the hats that I wear is I'm so lucky to spend a couple of nights a week in a room with arguably some of the world's smartest business school students. And one of the things that always scares some of them is like, you know, who is this sales guy standing in front of us? He's selling me something. And, you know, the context that I put it in is, you know, I'm trying to grow my business. I'm trying to grow your business. The more quickly I can listen and pause and make room for conversation and build trust, the sooner I'm going to find out if there's an opportunity there. But if there's not, I'm not going to force it. I'm not going to lead you down a path just to lead you down the path. Because that creates, as you know, as is obvious, that creates all kinds of badness for me and for you. So, you know, why would I do that? So it's that skepticism partly that I'm trying to address, but this is what, you know, these tools that you're suggesting and that we're talking about is what, that's how influence is built. And I think you're right to say trust is at the core of that. Absolutely it is.
You've got another section in here called Be Human, which I would roll up under caring too, but you've got some ideas under this. Share what you mean by be human. And before you do that, just one quick thought about the students. I spoke to a group of entrepreneurs a couple of weeks ago, and I asked them to raise their hand if they were in commission-only sales, and I didn't have a single hand go up. And then I asked them to raise their hand if the ability to influence and persuade people around some idea where they could together do something that they couldn't do alone was critical to their success in business and in life, and every hand went up. So this is sort of that Dan Pink idea, we're all the time selling, right? And we're human beings, and that's at the essence of who we, what we are. So that's where caring comes in. Run us down the path of what it means to be human.
Well, so I'm going to answer your question, and I'm going to reference what you just said in the answer to the question. Here's what's interesting. I got really lucky a couple of weeks ago with a client. I spoke right after Dan Pink, and of course, he is just fascinating, and I follow him. He's wonderful. I love his new book called To Sell as Human. And watching Dan, so here's what we're getting at in our ebook about being human. I think what is what creates influence, and of course I've got a whole book about this, but is our ability to tell a story. And you know, you do this really well on your site. You tell great stories, and that is what humanizes things, gives us context, and it allows us to show a bunch of things. It allows us to show what success looks like, what failure looks like. In my book, Anthony, I talk about the four types of stories that leaders and successful salespeople use, and they are success, failure, fun stories, and legends. And what I mean by legends is sort of a two-part definition. Legends are what you're probably thinking, which is, you know, the sort of once upon a time, really rich, deep, sort of historical or religious or spiritual teaching story. That's a legend. Or if you told me a story about Steve Jobs or, you know, Anita Roddick or Richard Branson, those are business legends that we all know because we all swim in the same business culture. And my point about being human is, man, let your stories fly. They're the things that give facts and research and evidence life. And if I can ask your permission to tell a very short story to illustrate this, I would love to do it.
Tell it.
Okay, good. I want to be sure that you didn't want to ask another question about this. So, and this is sort of interesting point because this is fact and evidence and research wrapped into the form of a story. So in 1997, three researchers walked into Carnegie Mellon's undergrad university, the student center, two women and a man, and they went up to those students and they said, hey, we're conducting a survey on how you use technology. And it'll take, you know, 6 to 8 minutes, no big deal. And for your trouble, we'll give you $5. So, you know, they got lots of undergrads to take it. It's, you know, basically a free $5. Why not? So they walked us down to the student center, you know, this young undergrad, Anthony, and his friend, Craig. And they walk them down. They walk us down to the student, another room in the student center. And they administer the survey on how we use technology. And it takes, you know, 6 minutes. We walk out and Anthony says to his friend, Craig, he says, hey, Craig, did you give any money to Rokia and save the children? And I look at my friend Anthony, I look at you and I say, well, yeah, I gave some money to save the children, but Rokia, what are you talking about, Anthony? I don't understand what you're talking about. And you say, Craig, well, you took that technology survey, right? In my envelope with my $5 after I took the survey, there was a pledge form from Save the Children in Africa. And it said, in Malawi, Africa, there's a young girl who's 9 years old named Rokia. She's dying of a waterborne illness. It's entirely treatable. Blah, blah, blah. Save the children. So I gave some money, Craig. Did you give any money? And I say, well, that's funny, Anthony. In my envelope with my $5, I also had a pledge form from Save the Children in Africa. And in my pledge form said, in Malawi, Africa, on an annual basis, there are 9 million cases of waterborne illness. There are 11 million cases of malaria. They're all entirely treatable. Blah, blah, blah. Save the children. So it wasn't an experiment about technology at all. It was an experiment about the power and influence of facts versus story, or story versus facts. And they've repeated this, Anthony, over and over in different contexts. Don't get lost in the charity. It has nothing to do with Save the Children. You can do this on anything. And they've repeated this over and over again. Here's the interesting finding, of course. You, having gotten the story, on average, oh, and one other clever part of the experiment is they gave everybody $5 $1 bills instead of a five. Very clever. Accounting for loose change in your pocket as an undergrad at Carnegie Mellon, you, Anthony, who got the story, gave $2.38 to Save the Children. I, on the other hand, gave $1.14. I got the fact-based pledge. You got the story-based pledge. The story-based pledge yielded more than twice what the fact-based pledge. It was an experiment to understand why and how do stories influence and humanize us. And I just think it's such a, it's sort of, and I what I've done is I've given you a little bit of both. I've given you some fact. It's a research project. It's actually research we can study. But it's also just a powerful way to, it's a powerful way to think about if I'm a salesperson and I'm walking in with all the features and feeds and speeds, how can I communicate that in the form of a story that we know will be much more influential. Let me stop there. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And let me share a story with you that sort of leads to this same place about what it means to be a human being and why I think being human counts for a lot more than facts or statistics or research. So in Canada, they ran a study of radiologists, and they sent a group of radiologists the normal pictures that they get to interpret whether or not a disease was present in the picture that they saw. They took that same group of radiologists, and instead of just sending the picture of the report, they sent an actual picture of the human being embedded in the chart so they could see the person whose chart it was that they were looking at. They could see their face. And in every chart, there's the possibility that a radiologist can find something that they're not looking for. They can find some other disease that wasn't on the request. They can find some other kind of illness. When the picture was there, they found 80% more secondary diseases that they weren't looking for than when there wasn't a picture there. They took those same radiologists a year later and sent them the same charts that they'd reviewed again with the pictures, without the pictures. And the percentage dropped dramatically. They didn't find the secondary without the picture there. And it's because there's a story when we see that face, right? And there's no story when it's just a radiologist, you know, an x-ray or a CAT scan or whatever the case may be. I think that's the real power of this. We're human, and when you put a face with it and you put a name with it and you put that story there, then it becomes real. When you share the facts and figures, it's not as convincing or compelling to us.
Well, it decontextualizes and it takes the emotion away. I mean, talk about book is stories do, and your illustration is a perfect example. Stories do two things that facts do not. They add context so we can see the whole picture. Just exactly your picture of the person for the radiologist. And they connect with emotion. And, you know, you have to be careful, right, in business talking about emotion. I don't mean, you know, I don't necessarily mean I make you laugh or make you cry. It's not necessarily high drama. These can be very standard stories. I told you nothing about Rokia.
Yes.
I'm years old and where she lives. I didn't give you a picture. I didn't tell you what she's like. I didn't tell she's happy. I didn't tell you any of that stuff. But yet it doesn't matter. That's what's striking about your example. You just show me a picture. You're not telling me anything about it. And somehow I am more thorough, more human. It humanizes the job. And I just think there's a real concrete lesson in there for us that, gosh, first of all, there's a lot of lessons. First of all, if you're going to err on the side of story. And I look back, Anthony, at my career. I started, you know, 25 years ago at IBM. And that was a great, great opportunity for me to be with such a great company. You know, and I sold bits and bytes. I sold features, feeds, and speeds because that's what I knew. And I didn't know anything about business. And I didn't know anything about how, you know, you were this guy running this company and I had to relate to you. And it's only when I learned that and was able to start telling other people your story of how you had success with this system, this IBM thing. And that's when I became successful. And I just got really interested in that later on to really capture why is it that stories are powerful. It's really those two things, context and emotion, and that's what makes us human.
So many presentations I've seen, the salesperson runs through a PowerPoint, lots of here's who we are, lots of this is what we do, lots of technical stuff. And then you get to the client's turn to ask a question and they say, what would you do if this came up? And what they want to hear is the story of what that's going to feel like to work with you. They want you to share something that walks them through what that experience is going to be like because you didn't share the story.
Right. Right. And exactly. And my point, I mean, you're really right on top of the point that I make, which is if that's true, if what you say is true, that I as a salespeople need a story in that moment, which I, you know, 1000% agree with you, Anthony. If that's true, then where do I get the stories? Do I have that quiver on my back such that I can pull out the red arrow versus the green arrow? The green arrow would be better for Anthony because he's this kind of guy. The red arrow better for Susan because she's this kind of woman. You know, it's really being discerning and intentional about the stories we tell. I'm going to tell Anthony this story because I think it'll really highlight what he's feeling, what he's worried about, what keeps him up. Susan, totally different person. I'm going to choose a different story. But you got to have them. You got to have the stories. And we have all these facts and we gather all these evidence and we have all these PowerPoint slides, which is fine. That's fine. But man, we got to translate those into stories because that's what makes us powerful and influential. I get nuts about it. Like, we know this. And that I catch myself like sharing evidence and then walking out, Greg, wait a second, guy, you should have told the story. That's what they're going to remember.
Absolutely. When we started this talking about Dan Pink, I mean, Dan Pink's research, and you know, he sort of did an anthropological thing by hanging around with some salespeople, but it's the story that makes Dan Pink a great writer. It's not what he comes up with as much as it is the stories he finds to illustrate it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was watching him with fascination and just, you know, I sort of like you, you know, you would be sitting there and like me, you'd be looking at what's his technique, what's his style, what's his content, how does he shape it all into a story? That's exactly what I was doing. And I was just fascinated. I mean, the guy is truly gifted. He's an unbelievable storyteller. And I got the treat of being able to follow him and just sit there and watch him tell those stories. But the stories, you know, they weren't just stories. And that's really my point with being human. I'm not just telling you any story. I'm going to tell you a story that I believe will have an impact for you. And you could tell that Dan was sharing stories that he had put together, not made up. That's a different thing. Yeah, that's fiction, right? Stories that he had put together and selected for this very audience. You know, and I'm sure that there would be some, you know, if I followed him the next day to another city and spoke with him, then there'd be some of the same stories. That's totally normal because some stories have powerful impact. And so you want to repeat them. But I'll bet you that he would, in a different city, have a slightly different set of stories to impact that unique group of people. And that's what I'm talking about. It's huge.
I want to thank you for spending time with us here. I love your ebook, and I'll put a link here to point people to that. But tell me, how do people find you?
Well, thank you, first of all. This has just been fantastic. I enjoy spending time with you and talking through these issues. The best way to find me and us is at Sales Engine. So it's just the website is just Sales Engine, just like it sounds, salesengine.com. The blog is there, and just, you know, sort of what we do, the conversation is there. So, and we're just delighted to be, you know, to be part of your world. We really appreciate it. I greatly appreciate it.
How about you personally? Twitter?
Yep. At Sales Engine and at Craig Wortman. And I've got a crazy last name, so I'll spell it. It's just C-R-A-I-G, Craig. And then Wortman is W-O-R-T as in Tom, M-A-N-N, two N's on the end.
Thanks so much.
Anthony, thank you so much. Have a great week and a great weekend, and I will talk to you soon.
You can find Craig at salesengine.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at salesengine or at Craig Wortman, W-O-R-T-M-A-N-N. As always, you can find me at thesalesblog.com. When you go there, do sign up for the Sunday newsletter. Thanks for being here. I look forward to seeing you next week in the arena.